The defending champion Eagles will have their work cut out for them against a fast and talented Falcons D, and how Atlanta's offense can get back on track after a down year. We're breaking down the big season opener. Plus, Derrick Henry's skill set, the Rams' potential Achilles heel, and more in the mailbag. It's all on the MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast. Hello and welcome to the NFL Deep Dive Podcast. I'm Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. This is the first one of these we have done since the 2016 season, and we are very excited to be doing the Thursday show again.
I love the Thursday show. I like the look-ahead stuff. It gets more strategic. To me, it's more about the details of football and the process behind it. I don't think we're going to... Are we picking games? We're not going to have to pick games or anything, are we, this year? You're probably going to make me pick this first one we're going to do.
Probably, yeah. You're probably going to have to make a lot of predictions.
Yeah, well, that's what I've done. I told you I need to do that magazine, then all the local radio stations call and want to talk about in great detail about the prediction. Why'd you pick our team to go 5-11? And I honestly usually don't even remember what I picked the teams to go because it's all a big, giant guessing game. But I did pick the Eagles to win the NFC East, and I picked the Falcons to win the Super Bowl.
Ooh, there you go.
Ooh, so we already talked about that. Why are you sounding surprised?
Now I'm just feigning surprise. Yes. But let's get into it. We are going to, just so everyone knows, we're going to be doing the show every Thursday during the season, except for next week. We are going to do it on Friday so that we can talk about what happens in this Thursday night opener. So we'll talk about that in the lead of the Deep Dive show on Friday, and then we will... talk about Packers Bears and some of the other big games coming in week one. But let's go Falcons Eagles here, and let's start. You know, obviously we're doing this a little bit early. We're not 100% sure whether it will be Foles or Wentz under center for the Eagles. I think we're leaning Foles at this point, and so let's move forward with that a little bit. But, you know, Andy, when you look back at last year's Super Bowl, and obviously we talked about this quite a bit, Malcolm Butler's out, you know, the Patriots didn't have the guys to match up with the Eagles' weapons. That played a big role in the Eagles being able to put up the kind of yards and points they did in the Super Bowl. It seems like it's going to be the complete opposite in this game. It seems like you know, there's going to be no Alshon Jeffrey. It's unclear whether Jay Ajayi will be available for this game. But when you look at the passing game weapons for the Eagles, it seems like they're at a disadvantage at every spot against who the Falcons can counter with. You know, whether it's you know, Falcons have two great guys on the outside with Trufant and Alford. You have Keanu Neal as a guy who can counter Zach Ertz. You have Deion Jones and Devondre Campbell, two really athletic linebackers to match up with anyone coming out of the backfield. It seems like this is going to be, let's just say, infinitely more difficult for the Eagles to find mismatches.
Well, I think the first thing to remember, the last time we saw Atlanta, they were playing at Philadelphia. And that game, the score of that game was 15-10. Neither offense got going that night. So I agree with you. We forget about that because, and you and I have been more guilty of this probably than anyone, we sensationalize and get all excited about what Foles did in the postseason. We forget there was that one game where they basically, they didn't hide Nick Foles, but they contained the game for him. And it wasn't just him. It was a windy night, too. That factored in.
It was a windy night. I did get the sense in that game, not that we have to recap that entire game, but they came out, they took a couple of deep shots early. I think they wanted to go aggressive, and then they immediately pulled back, in part because of the wind, but in part because Foles' first couple throws were pretty terrible.
Yeah, the wind caught that first deep ball. It was a Brian Poole pass interference on Torrey Smith, but the throw was horrendous, and they think they realized we can't throw into the wind. I am, but to answer your, let's take it to your question. Let's assume it's not going to be super windy on Thursday night. To take it to your question, before the Super Bowl, I went up to Eagles wide receiver coach, and he's now their offensive coordinator, Mike Groh, and we told him, and the guys don't, they don't want to talk scheme before the Super Bowl. So this kind of went, this was after we tried to go on the record and realized that it's just too much flirtation, not enough substance. So then we went off the record and talked, and we can say this now. I said, give me some of your ideas to beat man robber coverage, because I think that's what New England will play a lot against you. And he said, why do you think that? And I said, with all due respect to you, I think their defensive backs are better than yours. I think they match up really well. And that was clear through cornerback to safety, in my opinion. Zach Ertz would be an issue, I thought, but I didn't think anyone else in Philadelphia's offense posed a threat against New England's DBs. Obviously, I was horrendously wrong on that, and it's now made me almost gun-shy to make declarations about some of these Eagles wideouts, because I know it's different personnel this year, but in that system and in Doug Peterson's play calling, I saw those guys overachieve a lot last year. And it wasn't just all winning by design. There were times where the Eagles, they had players perform better than they usually perform. And that's probably why Groh's now the offensive coordinator.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's extend the fantasy that I just put out. Let's say they are going to have difficulty winning one-on-one matchups here. What can they do to sort of create some opportunities here in the passing game?
Well, the nice thing about the Falcons is you know what they're going to be in. If it's man coverage, they're going to be in man-free coverage. So one deep safety back, and then that leaves them with either a blitzer or a free defender in the middle of the field, and you can your approach is almost the same either way. You're going to call the same man-beater concept that you always call. If you get their zone coverage or cover three stuff, you can dink and dunk that. And that's what the Eagles did in that playoff game to Atlanta. They did it quite successfully. They had their running game got going, and then from there they were able to dink and dunk in the passing game. The reason you can dink and dunk against cover three is because of the structure of the defense. Teams will run these cover three beating route designs, and a lot of different plays, passing plays, they beat cover three by design. Mm-hmm. Now, the way they beat it is by pulling the linebackers back, and that creates a lot of space underneath. And that's a huge key. And that's, by the way, Dan Quinn has told me, that's why we go out and draft these fast linebackers, because we know our scheme gives up space underneath. So yeah. We've got to have linebackers that can run and turn, yeah, and they turn you don't want a four-yard completion becoming a 6 or 8 yard completion. That's what happened to the Falcons in the Super Bowl against the Patriots in the second half. You've got to have linebackers that can rally to the ball and make those 4 yard completions go for 4 yards. And most of the time the Falcons do, they got tired in that Super Bowl. They didn't that particular game, but that's the way the defense is built. Still, if you're a patient offense and you can run the ball well, which Philadelphia is both of those things, you can march up and down the field against that kind of defense.
Well, let's talk about the run game here for a second. The Eagles, as you have proclaimed them, had the most diverse run game in football last year. Still good on that, right, Andy?
I would be good on that still, yes, absolutely. Okay. The mobility of those interior linemen.
You look at the Falcons, and we've talked, Dontari Poe is, not time to bash Dontari Poe, but I think he's a little bit overrated, perhaps. I think people get a little bit excited about his raw skill set, and it hasn't really translated into any sort of dominant force. But I think it's clear the Falcons losing Poe, and it's probably going to be Terrell McClain replacing him. They're not great up front. And when you factor in the undersized linebackers, and really they're fast everywhere, but not big. This seems like the kind of front that the Eagles could take advantage with their run game.
I could see that, because you want to get that kind of front. I guess I was going to say you want to get them moving, but then we have to bring in the speed of the Falcons linebackers to the equation. Do you run straight at the Falcons, or do you try to run east and west against them, which is really where the Eagles, they're creative in their east and west run game. They do some nice stuff in their north and south run game too. A lot of trap plays and wham concepts where they leave first level or defensive line defenders, they leave them unblocked and they go right up to the linebackers. I would think you'll see some of that stuff. That would make good sense against them. For one, it's a great way to combat a gap shooter like Grady Jarrett. I mean, you fake block him and then you let him mm-hmm. penetrate in the backfield, and by then he's run himself out of the play. That's the beauty of that part is, hey, you now basically take care of their best defensive lineman without having to dedicate a full-time blocker on them. But then B, is that full-time blocker now becomes a full-time blocker on the linebacker. And you want to get a body up on Deion Jones because he is small, and he's not going to shed that block very well. So I to answer your question, Gary, I think the Eagles will see a lot of their stuff, a lot of their different schematic stuff. And the more I think about it as we go along here, the more I believe it's going to be between the tackles,
yeah,
north-south running.
No, absolutely. I think at the very least they have to test this Falcons interior front early on here,
and
and see what they can get here.
I would agree with that. And you want to get those linebackers reacting to you, and you're facing fast linebackers. And by the way, Duke Riley might be the fastest linebacker in Atlanta. He doesn't play a whole lot. He'll probably play more this year. But they've got three super, Deion Jones, Devondre Campbell, and Duke Riley, three super fast linebackers. You want to get guys like that reacting and kind of hesitating just a little bit to negate that speed. And I think the way you do that is to go after them. In this case, there are other times you want to try to attack them schematically. These guys, I just go after them right away and make them have to face blockers.
Anything else you want to talk about when it comes to Eagles offense versus Falcons defense?
Not really, other than it'll be interesting, especially with the injuries at wide receiver for Philadelphia right now, it'll be interesting to see what they do with their two tight end packages with Zach Ertz and Dallas Goedert there. And last year, you know what you're going to get. Keanu Neal and Devondre Campbell will be the ones who match up against those guys. But I'm real interested to see what it means when those two are on the field together.
Yeah, Dallas Goedert is a fun rookie here. Nice replacement they got for Trey Burton. And I think we're gonna have to see him thrown into the fire early here, straight out of South Dakota State. Not to be confused with Carson Wentz's alma mater in North Dakota State. But Andy, before we move on, you know, only with NFL Game Pass you get every out-of-market game, preseason game, live, top rookies, comeback players, new players on new teams. It all happens in the preseason live with NFL Game Pass. That's actually the only place so far you've been able to see a little bit of Dallas Goedert. Now, I'm not sure who's going to be protected, who's going to stay on the sideline for this final week of the preseason, but I do hope we get to see Lamar Jackson one more time. He seemed to have made some strides in the last week's game against Miami, and I think there are better things coming down the line for him as he becomes more comfortable against NFL defenses here. I can watch Lamar Jackson and the Ravens live in the preseason, and if I miss his game, I can replay it after it's aired. Whoever you want to watch this preseason, you'll need NFL Game Pass to do so if you're out of market. But I think my favorite thing about preseason week four is its chance to see all those Cinderella stories emerge. All the guys you've never heard of who will become impact players in the league. I remember the years, Willie Parker, Victor Cruz, Fred Jackson up in Buffalo. Those are the guys who emerged in the final preseason week. It's really a great opportunity to see who's next. Make sure to watch all the action this preseason with NFL Game Pass. Best of all, you can kick off the 2018 NFL season with a 7-day free trial of NFL Game Pass. Sign up now at NFL.com/MMQB10things. That's NFL.com/MMQB10things. Game on. And of course, as Andy and I always, always, always say, if you like this show and you want to see some of the stuff we talk about for yourself, they have the coaches film on there on NFL Game Pass. It is a great resource. So go get it. It's strongly recommended. That's my spiel. Let's go on to Falcons offense versus Eagles defense. This will be a storyline we're going to talk about a lot this year, Andy. But Steve Sarkisian obviously did not go particularly well in year one, but we've seen that over the years. Matt Ryan, year one under Dirk Cutter, not very good. Year two, much better. Year one under Kyle Shanahan, not very good. Year two, he's NFL MVP. What has to happen? What's sort of your prescription for what the Falcons should be doing this year? And then we'll get into specifically what they should try and do against this Eagles defense.
It's a big question because it's a lot of subtle answers that comprise the question. It has to do with how the Falcons intertwine their running game and their passing game, which is what Shanahan was always tremendous at. And you know, Gary, it's probably one of these that's easiest to, if we just take one specific example, and there's a very clear one that applies to this game, and it gives some people an idea of what you can expect. One thing that the Falcons did in the postseason game against Atlanta last year that conceptually was smart, and I think it went decently for them, and other teams had done this late in the year. The Rams did against the Eagles. They put their receivers in the minus splits. We've talked about that with the Rams as well before. The receivers close to the formation. They're not spread out wide. They're mm-hmm. in minus splits. And from there, they use the receivers as crackback blockers on the defensive ends, and they run outside against them. And when you do that, that's a good way to slow down the Eagles' front four. And this is an example of how you intertwine your running game and passing game, because a lot of those play-action concepts that you run, especially like think of the quick slants to Julio Jones that he is so good on, those yep. usually come out of minus splits. Yeah, that's how you get to the middle of the field quick enough. You line up near the middle of the field. So I think it's important the Falcons come out and condense their formations and force the Eagles' defensive line to contemplate the idea of being blocked by a wide receiver, because D linemen hate that. Even though wide receivers are small guys, they always come from an angle that you can't see them, and they can be some thunderous blocks from that. You do that early in the game, and then you can start faking those blocks, and that slows down the D line and gets your outside zone running game going. All of this stuff is the, and they did it again last year in Atlanta. They just weren't very good at it. I think they'll be better at it in year two, and I think this needs to be the foundation of their offense, that kind of approach. It's not just something to do against the Eagles because they're better than you on the D line. This kind of thing needs to be your foundation, and it starts in this game. I think we'll see it Thursday night.
Well, does that kind of make up for the fact, you know, we talked 2 years ago when Kyle Shanahan would use those three tight end sets, not extensively, but they were interesting. They were almost like a special package they put out there, and it went really well when they actually used them. They really don't, you know, Falcons don't really have the personnel to do that. Not that they ever had stars, but you know, it's Austin Hooper, Logan Paulson, and Eric Saubert at this point. They're not going to do a lot of three tight end stuff. If you start condensing those formations, you almost turn your receivers into tight ends, especially when you have they have big guy. I mean, Mohamed Sanu is a big guy. Julio Jones is a big guy. Yeah. They can do some damage as blockers.
They can, and then the other offshoot from that is those running backs can become the outside receivers. You can run them to the flat, which is what they did in that game a lot. So the receivers' routes go inside, the running backs' routes go outside, and you're still balancing the field and just creating different matchups. And remember, the Eagles, they're primarily a cover three defense as well. We don't think of it that way because they don't play quite as regularly. Like they're not committed to it snap after snap, but that's definitely their most common approach defensively, and so you know what you're getting with them. The key is, Gary, what we had to talk about is how do you contest with that defensive line that they have there. I think a big guy for Atlanta this year is going to be Brandon Fusco, who they signed in free agency at right guard to replace mm-hmm. Wes Schweitzer. And it's interesting because Fusco, years ago, he was kind of the Wes Schweitzer of the Vikings. He was the clear weak link. He played right guard. One of his coaches told me no coach has worked with any player as much as I worked with Brandon Fusco. And that work paid off. That was Ryan Silverfield, by the way. He's now the coach at Memphis, O-line yep. coach. But that work with Fusco paid off because Fusco has become a quality starter. And I think if I'm Wes Schweitzer's position coach, I tell him, hey, look at the guy that we're replacing you with and use that as motivation that, hey, you can get better and you'll be replacing someone someday. Atlanta's better at guard, though, and we'll see if that gives them a little more of a fighting chance to mm-hmm. survive the Fletcher Cox matchup. They got killed by that matchup last year.
Yeah. Yeah. Fletcher Cox dominated that game back in January, divisional round. How are they going to counter Julio Jones in this game? When you looked at Eagles' team last year, I think everyone pointed to the cornerbacks as the weak links, and I don't know if it's necessarily a strength at this point, but they're certainly much deeper. There were some whispers that Ronald Darby might be moved because they were comfortable with the way Sidney Jones, who is basically a, you know, he was a second-round pick last year. He would have been a first-round pick had he not torn his Achilles during a pre-draft workout. Rasul Douglas another year. They apparently like the rookie Avante Maddox, who they took in the fourth round this year. And obviously mm-hmm. Jalen Mills is still there. There's some depth, though.
Yeah, and Mills is actually, I think, the best of those guys, which is surprising because we see him. He looks bad on TV at times. I remember our buddy Anthony Brown, who I fell in love with in Dallas, and he would get beat bad on TV four or five times, and they happened to be nationally televised games, and so that's what everyone thought of him. That happened a little bit with Mills down the stretch last year with some double moves that he gave up. But in the big picture, the overall picture, Jalen Mills was a solid corner, and he's the guy that teams avoided, I would say. Like Darby is the one you game plan to go after between those two, even though I bet a lot of people would think Darby's the better of the two corners. Mm-hmm. To answer your question, Gary, the Falcons can do whatever they want because these corners don't move around. Mills will almost certainly play the left side, Darby the right side. We'll see who plays the slot, Maddox or Sidney Jones, probably one of them, maybe Malcolm Jenkins if they go big nickel. You know where the defenders will be, though, in Philadelphia. They rarely move their corners around. So how you beat them is by just not letting their pass rush beat you.
I mean, it feels like the Falcons should score points in this game. I mean, not 40 points, but certainly not 16 points or whatever they were putting up a lot of times last year.
See, have we had a lot of season openers the last few years have turned out to be shootouts? I know last year was Kansas City and New England, but remember the Denver and Baltimore a few years ago where Denver scored, what was it, 8,000 touchdowns against the Ravens? That was back in 2013.
That was,
I'm with you, though.
We had the Cam Newton in Denver game with the missed field goal at the end. That wasn't really a shootout. That was Trevor Simeon's first game.
Yeah. Well, I'm with you. I could see this being – I think the winning team will have something in the 30s for points.
Okay. Who do you think's going to win, Andy? You have
–
you know what? I'm just going to say, since you picked them to win the Super Bowl, you have to pick the Falcons this game. You don't have to say it.
I guess I do.
I'm just going to say you I'm just going to say it for you.
All right, and I'm going to say this. If they lose the game, I will not regret my Super Bowl pick one bit because – in fact, I would double down on the Super Bowl pick and say I still think Atlanta's going to win it, the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Just like New England got to the Super Bowl last year after losing week one.
Do you, by the way, do you know the spread in this game?
I do not, but this is
a
wrong show, Gary.
You're
just trying to find a way to promote your gambling show. Just want
we
you
are
just
about
get the
to
spiel.
Promote it.
My guess on the spread would be Eagles plus two.
Wait, Eagles by two or Eagles?
Yeah, like they. I don't remember how this works. I am not a gambling guy at all. They think the Eagles will win by two in Vegas. Is how I'm trying to say this.
So you would say Eagles minus two.
I hate that. Doesn't that seem backwards?
No, because the way you think about it is you subtract or add X amount of points to this team's final score to figure it out.
Oh.
But it does a little bit because I realize the minus implies something negative. The plus implies something positive. Who doesn't want three more points? But you were close. Eagles by three at the moment.
Okay.
So that's so tragically, if you're an Eagles fan, you don't even get to wear your latex dog mask to the game because you're the favorite this time. You'd look ridiculous.
Doug Peterson should have his PR staff go through and look at all the preseason predictions that everyone is making. I haven't heard a single person pick the Eagles to repeat, and he ought to go through and then have them research when's the last time that nobody picked the Super Bowl champ to get back to the Super Bowl, because I don't know anyone that's picking Philadelphia to get back there.
Yeah, I mean, over the years, it's been a lot of the team that gets there and loses doesn't always make it back, but yeah. Not a whole lot of love for the defending champs. In the defense of pundits everywhere, it's tough to project this team because you don't know when Wentz is coming back to the field at the moment.
Well, Doug Peterson taping, just has to bang a locker and say we did this without Wentz for a little bit last year. We're a mm-hmm. whole team. We're one. You know, there's a motivational speech just sitting there for him to take if he wants it.
Oh, I'm sure he will take it. I do want to, of course, since we just talked about the spread, I just want to remind everyone, the MMQB Gambling Show, that is myself, my brother Scott Gramling, who is the managing editor of Daily Racing Form Sports, and Jimmy Traina, who is the host of the SI Media Podcast. We get together every Friday and talk lines and over-unders and all that stuff if you're into that sort of thing, and surely you are now. That gambling is, as far as everyone is concerned, completely legal, endorsed by the government. If you're out in Europe, it was already legal. But let's move on. We're going to open up the mini mailbag, though. I have one more thing to say before the mini mailbag, Andy, because I thought this was a great note from Albert Breer here. We had talked about in Monday's show Jacoby Brissett and what could the Seahawks' motivation be to make a deal for him, and are they sort of putting in another option in case they say, you know, this thing hasn't worked with Russell on the big contract. Do we want to entertain trying to get the super cheap quarterback again? But Albert Breer, who obviously is also the host of the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer, with Jenny Prentice and Connor Orr, you can get that every Wednesday. His note was that no quarterback on a contract with an average per year of $20 million has ever won the Super Bowl.
All right. Well, that's to me, that's a fun fact.
You don't find that interesting? That's an interesting fact.
No, because for the $20 million a year threshold's only been in play for a few years now, because the salary cap used to be lower and there's inflation that you have to account for. So, yeah. I mean, how many $20 million contracts per year have there even been?
That's fair enough. But let me fortify this this note here. Yeah, Peyton Manning. So Peyton Manning was making $19.2 million. So let's. We'll say that with inflation, that's $20 million. He was a $20 million quarterback in today's dollars. The other guys, Joe Flacco, $4.76 million. Russell Wilson, $750,000. Brady did it 1 year on $9 million and 1 year on $15 million. And Nick Foles, $5.5 million.
It's interesting. So, the more I think about it, the more interesting. Yeah. It still feels like a really good fun fact, but if someone wants to say, no, there's something behind it, I could see. I mean, it's interesting. I'll give him that. I'm trying to think, where was Drew Brees in 2009 when he was...
Brees was probably not.
I mean, he wasn't over 20, but where was he compared to the rest of the NFL? I'm looking up his salary now. He's, 2009, his base salary was extremely low. How did that work out? Interesting.
So at the time, he had a Spotrac said he had a total cash of just under $13 million that year when they won it.
Wow, and that can't be very high. I mean, it's probably near the top, but there's got to be someone that had more. Matt Castle had just been signed by the Chiefs not long ago.
No,
you know what? All right, I'll give it to Breer. That's a fascinating. That's either the best fun fact I've heard, or like one of the lower regular facts I've heard, with the potential to climb very high the more I think about it.
No, it's a good set. I mean, look, everyone's instinct, and we talked about it. It's so anti-intuitive to think the Seahawks would even entertain the fact of maybe we move on from Russell, and we're not saying they're moving on from Russell. We're just throwing it out there as, you know, could this be a motivation for going after Jacoby Brissett? Do they want the guy on the super cheap deal, and do they want to say we're going to build it like we used to build it? But you look over the history of the league here, you would think that teams just want to chase their quarterback, get their quarterback, and they'll figure everything out. But obviously, it's not that easy. Let's open the mailbag, Andy.
Love it.
First one.
Love the mailbag. Glad we're back after taking a week off from the mailbag.
It's been a while since we took mailbag questions. We are going to do the mini mailbag. It is adorable. The baby size mailbag is going to be every deep dive show. We'll take a couple questions at the end of it. Probably less on the wacky questions and more on the more current events questions, but we won't rule out anything. This first one, I'm actually going to grab this off of Twitter, Andy, because you had a series of people ask you to explain the following tweet from @Andy_Benoit. Andy, can you explain what you mean by, quote, Derrick Henry is more of a strong runner than a powerful runner? Subtle difference.
Very subtle, probably too subtle for Twitter, because you said the bosses, Mark Moravec, didn't like the tweet either.
He did not.
The head boss, the big guy in charge, yeah. And Moravec, by the way, does not follow me on Twitter, so I don't even know how he saw that
tweet.
He doesn't follow me. Yes, it is, and I confronted him about it, and he said it's because I tweet so many boring film things.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm. I thought so, too.
Them's fighting.
Oh, that was a striking blow. I know. I thought he would say it was an oversight. Like, oh, I meant to follow you. I didn't. But no, it was. Yeah, I know I don't follow you, and he had a reason why.
He was honest. That's nice.
Yeah, it's nice in the concept, and then when someone's actually honest with you, you hate them for it. That's how it goes. I love Mark Moravec, though, and it's a fair question. Like, what's the difference between power runner and strong runner, and as it applies to Derrick Henry, he's a build-up speed guy. He is not an accelerator. He's an accelerator after 10 yards, but the first 10 yards, which is really where acceleration occurs, that's not what he is. That's why he needs his blocking lanes defined. That's why he lost yardage, I think, on a fourth of his carries in college, because he's a slow build-up runner. But once he gets built up, he is hard to tackle. And to me, that's what you classify as a strong runner versus powerful, someone that can just lower the shoulder and immediately get through guys. And there's an explosiveness to them where they can not only run with strength but exert their strength as a weapon. Henry doesn't exert his strength as a weapon until he gets later into his runs. So that's what I was getting at the subtle difference. How many was that, 280 characters, or did I need to just not tweet that kind of thing?
How long was it? I always say never tweet anything, so I think you should just kept all of that to yourself. Or better yet, just put it in a nice article where you could explain the whole thing or talk about it on this show. We have so many different ways of talking about stuff.
What an age we live in. Does that make sense to you, or does it? I mean, what do you think of that?
So when I read the tweet, I always think the difference between a big churning back and a back like, let's say, a Marshawn Lynch or a young Adrian Peterson, a young Marshawn Lynch.
Yep.
The ultra-violent guys who...
They're perfect, yeah.
That's what my mind went to.
So you just used better words than I did. That's all you did.
Yeah.
You replaced powerful with violent, which paints a better image, better picture. And you replaced strength with churning, which is a more specific type of strength. That's why you're the editor and I'm the mere scribe.
This is a mere scribe indeed. That is your official title. The other thing I think about when I think about that difference is, the strong guy would be the guy who is dragging three tacklers with him who are all sort of like hanging on him until he falls to the ground like Gulliver's Travels or something. Whereas the powerful runner is the guy who's sort of it looks like it hurts to tackle him. Like it looks like you are getting bruised ribs and just it looks really unpleasant.
Yep.
Well, there you go. Anyone wondering about that tweet? You have your answer. First real mailbag question here. This is coming from Kev. You guys talked about how high Aaron Donald is ranked, yet even if he were the number one defensive player in the league, it did not help the Rams' defense sufficiently enough last season. What is missing with their defense? I'll sum that up real quick. Just obviously Aaron Donald was defensive player of the year last year. We've talked about whether it's deserved. Andy sort of points to their poor ranking as a run defense. I tend to point to the fact that he really only played like 14 games, though I did vote for him in our MMQB poll anyway.
Of those games he sat by choice too. McVay sat him because it was a meaningless game against San Francisco in week 17.
That is a good point. He wouldn't have played that even if he played the opener.
Well, and the other thing, and I know you're still talking, not to get too sidetracked, but the guys that were in contention for Defensive Player of the Year, at least front seven players, probably be Fletcher Cox, who missed some games. I think he missed three in October. Luke Kuechly missed some games in the middle of the season. So there weren't a lot of guys that played all 16 games last year on defense. I don't know why I'm saying this, because I didn't vote for Aaron Donald, and so this is hurting my case. But that's the Aaron Donald thing. It's a good question. I'll let you keep going, though, because I know what the question's about to be. It's a good question.
No, we've talked about on the show a little bit the fact that the Rams really don't have any edge guys. Obviously, once Donald is back and you have Donald and Sue in the middle, that's a lot of they have the ability to pressure the quarterback with those two guys. I did want to talk about their linebackers, though. They moved on from Alec Ogletree. I think he was a bit of a mixed bag last year anyway, but do they have good enough linebackers? Because I do think back to Wade Phillips last year in Denver, where teams were really exploiting their linebackers in the passing game.
And there are coaches around the NFL that believe that's a little bit of Wade Phillips' scheme, and that he becomes a little bit predictable when you make him play with more linebackers on the field. I've heard coaches say that. I don't know if that's true. Wade Phillips is one of the best in the business, but if you can get matchups against his linebackers in coverage, and that's true with any team, you're going to take that. Linebacker is the biggest question for the Rams. The question of, they're such a different defense than a year ago. We have to just put it on to this season because they have different cornerbacks. Robert Quinn's not there. Ogletree's not there. It's a different defense. There's questions at linebacker. Mark Barron's a very good player, but then it's who's going to step up around him. And at safety, free safety, LaMarcus Joyner is sensational. Strong safety, John Johnson, to me, is an interesting guy because he showed up really well on film at times last season, and he was brand new. I'd never seen him, so you get even more excited to go, who's that? But then there were other times that he was horrendous in run support angles, and it led to some really big plays. So he had a lot of highs and lows as a rookie. They obviously felt comfortable with the highs because he's now the starter, clearly the starter at safety. They don't have a lot of depth at any of these positions either. That's the other thing, Gary. In fact, they might be the thinnest defense in the NFL for just taking their second string and lining it up. Their D-line's not horrible. Ethan Westbrooks, I like him as a depth for defensive tackle, but it's not the deepest defense.
Yeah, I mean, they are that is going to be a big deal because they do have to stay healthy, because obviously when you load up on the kind of guys they've loaded up on, you sort of sacrifice depth with that. Sort of transitioning off of John Johnson and LaMarcus Joyner here, Michael D, friend of the show, asks, how many teams keep safeties on sides but are interchangeable when it comes to strong safety or free safety? Everyone ideally would want the Thomas Chancellor duo, but Washington, for instance, are having Nicholson and Swearinger do both, and they seem to be having some issues there, at least going into the season. So basically, Andy, the old thing was you have your strong safety, and that's your guy who's closer to the line of scrimmage. You got your free safety who's back there playing center field. For how many teams is it more of a side-to-side thing and sort of, interchangeable with the positions at this point?
It's becoming more interchangeable because of the way offenses are set up. We've talked about how RPOs are not the only thing that's sweeping the NFL. It's actually the bigger concept of changing this formation strength with decoy players. Think jet sweep guys or fake reverse guys. It's that, and then it's and you use those tactics to manipulate unblocked defenders. That stuff impacts safeties, because think about if there's a slot receiver that starts out on one side of the field and you got your strong safety down over the slot or on the side of the slot, and that receiver goes in hard motion to the other side and you're in zone coverage, you can't reorganize your guy. Your strong safety cannot run with that slot receiver and then hope that all the linebackers bump over a spot to reposition themselves. So the only answer is to then rotate your safeties. Your strong safety runs back to middle field, and your middle field safety, your free safety, he runs down and picks up the guy on the slot on the other side of the field. You have to rotate your safeties against a lot of pre-snap motion concepts because teams are snapping the ball so quickly off of the motion now. So safeties, whether they're interchangeable or not, it's almost academic because they have to be in it. They have to play that way. And that's a great thing. Offenses, I'm sure, notice when there's a guy, a strong safety, who is not great in coverage, I'm sure they find ways to use their pre-snap motion to force him into coverage.
Yeah. Last question here. This is Rafael from Brazil. My question is about the pros and cons of manufacturing QB pressure through scheme versus having a disruptive player to do the same thing. As a Saints fan, I figure that balances why the front office traded up to get Marcus Davenport in the draft. They think the disruptive player is the way to go. Is it a league-wide belief that it's better to have the single disruptive player, or does it vary from coaching staff to coaching staff? So basically, and look, no one, you know, anyone is going to take Von Miller or Khalil Mack or Joey Bosa, and you live with that. But is it common around the league for defensive coordinator to kind of say, you know, we don't necessarily need that guy. I'd rather do it. I'd rather put my investment elsewhere, and I'll come up with some creative ways to create that pressure.
Some guys are in one camp, others are in another camp. It has to do with how much you value cornerbacks, really, and what you think of them. And if you're going to be a pressure defense, you've got to have a few corners you trust in one-on-one man coverage. It's interesting, Gary, because I ask this kind of question a lot around the league, and the one thing coaches always tell me is that you want to generate pressure with four pass rushers. Everybody wants to do that, and if everybody had that ability, they'd do that every time. Just like the Eagles last year with that dominant D-line. Minnesota's got probably the second best pass rushing D-line in the NFC. I think they had one of the lowest blitz percentages in the NFC. If you've got the pass rushers, you want to use them. Now, the hard part is that there aren't enough of those pass rushers. It's more spots than talent at that spot. And then it's so important that if you don't have it, you can't just survive. If your pass rush doesn't get home, you got to find a different answer. You cannot line up and not have your pass rush get home. You'll get killed. So if you believe in your four-man rush, you're going to be a four-man rush team. If you don't believe you've got the D-line for that, then you're going to be a pressure manufacture team. That doesn't necessarily mean blitzing, but it means showing disguised looks and rushing with different guys and doing all those things. It comes down to, it's very personnel driven. It comes down to your personnel.
Yeah. All right. That's a wrap for the show. We're going to be back Monday with our season preview. We will be here every Thursday with a deep dive show. But again, next week, it's going to be Friday because we're going to wait, see what happens in that Eagles-Falcons opener, talk about that at the lead of the show, and then we'll also talk about some of the other big Week 1 games. So Friday next week, Thursday every other week during the season, mini mailbag. It's adorable. It's happening every Thursday. Send your questions in. talkback@themqb.com. Andy_Benoit, gremley_si. We're both on Facebook. Or send a good old-fashioned letter. Thanks to today's sponsor, NFL Game Pass. Without them, we wouldn't have this show. So please support them the way they support us. Thank you to our researcher, Reed Foster, for all the hard work making us sound smart. And thanks, as always, to producer Shelby Royston and all the guys at Cadence 13 who make us sound good. Most of all, thank you to you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB Deep Dive Podcast. The full feed is in, well, full swing at this point. Andy and I on Monday, Andy and I on Thursday, Breer, Jenny, and Connor on Wednesday, and the MMQB Gambling Show every Friday. We're really proud of them. We think it's a great lineup here. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys Monday morning.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.